Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon, everybody. Merry Christmas, and welcome to another hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. This is Bryant Shanley, executive producer of the program. And as I mentioned the other day, this week and next week, we're taking some time to do a little bit of a similar program to what we did in the past on Al Cresta's show. We used to call it the Cresta Countdown. We'd actually rank the top interviews of the year. This week and next, we're not ranking the top interviews of the last year, but we are going to share some with you, both commentaries from Marcus, interviews from Marcus, as well as material from Al. And we'll be doing that over the next hour. We'll have a conversation that Marcus had with Brad Berzer about looking at Nietzsche as destroyer. In his mockingly titled autobiography and final published work, Ecce Homo, Friedrich Nietzsche presented himself as the prophet of modernity. No one should underestimate Nietzsche's own vision of himself with that title. Intellectually brutalized, bloodied, and tortured, this 19th century philosopher presented himself as in the last words, to a world he wanted to overthrow. Brad Berzer joins us to talk more about this. He is co-founder and senior contributor to The Imagining Conservative and chairs the history department at Hillsdale College. Later in this hour, we ask, can Americans learn to trust again? Distrust of elites, cultural institutions, political parties, the news, and more, including even our own neighbors, is at an all-time high. Are we fated to come apart as a nation, or is there hope to be found right next door? Marcus will talk with Christine Rosen about this. She's senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And then finally, the last segment of today, we will share with you the last interview Al ever did. This is with Matthew Ramage asking the question, what changed after the fall? When faced with the question of why there is so much suffering in the world, the default Christian answer is because of Adam's sin. But the fossil record shows that animals were dying long before humans inhabited the planet. So what in the created order changed as a result of Adam's sin? As I said, this conversation with Matthew Ramage was the last interview Al ever recorded. We look back on it today. You know Matthew Ramage well if you listen to Marcus's program, professor of theology at Benedictine College and adjunct professor of sacred scripture at Holy Apostles College. That is all coming up in this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon after this news break.
Thank you, Bryant, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News, and today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Biden is commuting the death sentences of 37 people, leaving only three federal prisoners on death row in America. Biden announced this morning that he condemns the murders committed but can't in good conscience advocate for the death penalty at the federal level. Biden's administration has imposed a moratorium on executions, and the president says he can't let a new administration resume the executions that he halted. One of the victims of last week's shooting at a Christian school in Madison, Wisconsin, has been laid to rest. A public memorial at City Church in Madison was packed on Saturday with members of the community who were mourning 14-year-old Ruby Vergara, one of three people killed last Monday in a shooting at Abundant Life Christian School. The public service was followed by a graveside memorial service about 12 miles east of Madison. President-elect Trump is threatening the U.S. could take back control over the Panama Canal. Yesterday at Turning Point USA's America Fest, Trump told the conservative crowd, it will happen if Panama does not stop overcharging the U.S. for use of the key Central American waterway. Trump called the fees being charged by Panama ridiculous and highly unfair. And it's Festivus, the made-up holiday from the 90s sitcom Seinfeld. Celebrated every December 23rd, the alternative Christmas holiday involves food, family, and the airing of grievances. After that, you can wrestle friends and family as feats of strength. The holiday was inspired by real-life Seinfeld writer Dan O'Keefe's holiday traditions. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. In his mockingly titled autobiography and final published work, Ecce Homo, Behold the Man, Friedrich Nietzsche was presenting himself as not only a prophet of modernity, but a kind of Christological figure that in his person fulfills any notion of the kingdom and does away with any need for a Christian gospel. None of us should underestimate Nietzsche's own vision of himself with the title. Intellectually brutalized, bloodied, and tortured, the 19th century philosopher presented himself in his final words and his last words to a world that he desperately wanted to overthrow. You're joined by Brad Berzer to talk about this. Bradley J. Berzer, co-founder of and senior contributor at The Imaginative Conservative. He's also the Russell Amos Kirk Chair in History at Hillsdale College and fellow of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. He is the author of Behold the Demon, Nietzsche as Destroyer. Brad, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Marcus. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, the joy is completely mine. I've been wanting to speak with you ever since Nathan mentioned that you and I were kindred spirits in some ways.
That's great. I'm glad to know that.
So, one of the things we share is that we have a reluctant admiration for the kind of tenacity that Nietzsche shared, but I think it quite possibly ends there in terms of our admiration for the man. Why should we not underestimate him? He's prolifically influential, and why should we not underestimate his influence?
Well, I'm very taken with him in so many ways, and as I mentioned in the piece, I'm actually embarrassed that I'm taken with him. Mm-hmm. He's a great writer. He's a great thinker. He's a great storyteller, and he's captivating. Unlike so many other philosophers, Nietzsche could actually write and wrote beautifully. So there's always this sense, at least for me, that when I pick him up and read him, not only can I understand him, but I can also recognize that there's a genius there at work, even if right. I think it's a diabolic genius. And I compare him. You know, so just teaching Western civilization, I compare him to the other great thinkers of the 19th century. Think about someone like Darwin or Marx or Freud. But to me, if we jump 500 years into the future, and in 500 years we're looking back at the 20th century or the 19th century, I think that most scholars will see this as an age of Nietzsche rather than an age of Marx or of Freud. Or in maybe Darwin, but certainly I think Nietzsche is a key character in all of this. And I take part of that. I don't know if you've ever had a chance. This book is now probably a little dated, but in the 1980s, a great book by a British journalist, Paul Johnson, came out. The book was called Modern Times. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really first started getting interested in Nietzsche, because Johnson starts off his book with, if we really want to examine all the dictators of the 20th century, everyone from Lenin to Stalin to Mussolini to Hitler to Pol Pot, what they have in common is not Marx, but Nietzsche.
Right.
And so that really, I was in grad school when I read that, and that just really captured my imagination.
Right. And frankly, you can draw that line back. You know, any of us could say that Marx was influenced by Hegelian conflict dynamic, and Hegel himself and all of the postmodern philosophers were in some way influenced by one way, shape, or form. You've got Feuerbach's anthropological materialism, but Nietzsche was the most honest of them. This is how I've always taken it. He was a hero of mine at one point when I was a militant anti-theist. Nietzsche was honest in that he followed the thoughts of atheism to their logical conclusion. And it was nihilism. It was anti-theism and nihilism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the fact that his father was a Lutheran pastor, you know, I find that fascinating. I'm just from a biographical standpoint, what an amazing journey he had to reject his father and to reject all of that. And of course, he was young. He was only about 12 at the time that he rejected the teachings of his father. His father had already passed away, but to reject that and then to try and spend his life overcoming all of that Christianity. It's an incredible story.
Right. And incredible in a rather shocking way. You read Ecce Homo.
Yes.
You read Ecce Homo. And, go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, and again, I mentioned this in the piece as well, and I always joke with my students, it's like every time I teach Nietzsche or read him, I'm both taken with him and repulsed to the point where I feel like I need to take a shower and go to confession.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that kind of love-hate relationship that I have with him.
Right, yeah. I think of Nietzsche the way I think of a nuclear reaction. It's fantastic. It achieves a tremendous amount of influence, but I want to stay as far away from it as possible.
Stay as far away from possible, exactly.
So,
no, that's exactly right.
So going back to H.A. Homo, there's this real delusion of messianic grandeur in the way he views himself and his great experiment, his great journey, if you will, to liberate the masses from the opiate of religion and religiosity. There's a real kind of love-hate relationship with the figure of Christ at all in Nietzsche.
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating study. And of course, we don't know, even his greatest supporters, we just don't know if he was insane at that moment or
right.
not. And, you know, he suffered from syphilis, of course, and this is a time before antibiotics, so it just ate away at the brain. And it's really hard to know how lucid he was when he was writing this.
Mm-hmm.
The copy I have is just the Penguin Classics copy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating that the person who writes the introduction really bends over backwards to claim that this was all part of the humor of Nietzsche.
What?
And I don't see that. I'm sure Nietzsche could be playful. There's no doubt about that. He could be very playful. But it's still, there's a darkness there that is so deep
yep.
that it's not just humor. There's something else going on
That's right.
in all of this.
That's right.
And, you know, for Nietzsche, I mean, he thought of himself as the manifestation of the Holy Spirit
mm-hmm.
at one point. He thought his own writings were a fifth gospel.
Yep.
Yeah, so he's deeply, deeply beholden to Trinitarian Orthodox Christianity.
Yep.
Deeply. I mean, we could never explain his character without reference to Christianity.
That's right.
But at the same time, of course, as you and I have been talking, he rejects it
yep.
so soundly.
In fact, he springboards his entire philosophical framework off of the heritage of Judeo-Christianity and Christendom, and that becomes the source of his success, but eventually a source of his epistemological downfall. One of the things
yeah.
I do want to highlight is he identifies with Dionysius. And what's odd is Dionysius starts off as a Stoic and becomes a consummate hedonist. And that mirrors Nietzsche's own journey from stalwart Lutheranism into early thinker into full-blown nihilist hedonist.
Yeah, well put. And after the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, right,
mm-hmm.
that should be at the forefront of all of our minds right now. What was going on with that? And there was, I think, a kind of a Nietzschean statement with that. But certainly, you know, for Nietzsche, to think about the birth of tragedy and to think about the essence of drama, whether it's Richard Wagner or whether it's going back to Aeschylus,
mm-hmm.
right? There's just something, deep in Nietzsche in which he is truly, again, an anti-Christian, but so deeply rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Yep. And the sheer oddity of it all, that he, in Ecce Homo, identifies as the fulfillment of the kingdom of God on earth. You talk about this anti-theism, but you talk about the manifestation of the kingdom that finds its fulfillment in his person.
Right, right. And so, again, there you have that oddity with Nietzsche. And one of the books that, and I think I recommended this in my piece, one of the books I absolutely love is Henry de Lubach's
mm-hmm.
Drama of Atheistic Humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And he does such a great job of putting Marx and Nietzsche in their place. Because obviously, when we get into the 20th century, yeah, there's a great Christian humanism as well.
Right.
People like Christopher Dawson and C.S. Lewis, Willa Cather here in America. I mean, it's so many great Christian humanists. But there you have that legacy of atheistic humanism as well.
Yep. Brad, this was such a joyous conversation, and I'm glad that many of us are seeing the sheer impact Nietzsche has on our modern sphere. My guest has been Bradley Berzer, co-founder of and senior contributor at The Imaginative Conservative, Russell Amos Kirk, chair in history at Hillsdale College and fellow of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, and we've been talking about the heritage of Nietzsche in destroying the thought of the West. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Distrust of elites, cultural institutions, political parties, and even our neighbors is at an all-time high. Are we fated to come apart as a nation at the lowest level societally? Or is there hope to be found right next door? Christine Rosen joins us. She is Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Christine, it's great to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
And on so crucial a topic. So let's talk about an overview here. We have a problem in trust. You don't even have to look too far. A number of surveys out there showing that given the state of the economy that it is and the state of dissolution in public discourse, the average American does not trust their governing elite.
Yes, it's actually been something that some organizations such as the Pew Research Center and others have done surveys on for decades. And it's worrisome to see the trend continue not only to go down slowly, but to have accelerated quite a bit in recent years. I think a lot of the experience of the COVID pandemic years and people placing faith in their public health institutions and in the federal government in particular and finding that faith and that trust repeatedly broken has led to some of these more worrisome numbers. And the number that really was leaping out at me is that fewer than 2 in 10 Americans say they trust our elected officials in Washington to do what is right just about always. Only 1% of Americans believe that. And only 15% believe that our elected officials in Washington are trying to do what's right most of the time. So those are not numbers that any elected official should think aren't anything but serious. It's a serious problem.
It's terrible that the statistic that you cited is what we knew to be true during the administration of George W. Bush's time in office. And little has changed in the public sphere. One would hope that at the very least we'd see an ebb and flow on the rise, but that isn't the case.
No, it's not. And I think some of that speaks to the fact that there's a broader, almost cynicism about some of our important institutions. And this is a problem that extends beyond government. It speaks to our faith in things like the media, educational institutions, and even our local institutions, our local communities. People just simply aren't feeling like they can trust one another in quite the same way. And this, again, this is a problem that's been of long standing, but mm-hmm. in recent years, it's really been exacerbated.
And as you highlighted, the problem here isn't just how the average American views the office of the president. This is across the board. The general view of our executive, legislative, and judiciary branches, and institutions at large, the average American doesn't seem to trust any of them.
Yes, and I wonder, I mean, I'm trained as a historian, and so one of the things I really wanted to question was, how did we get to this place? How is it that we have such a broad sense of mistrust? And I think we can really look at some of the ways that our own history of our own country is being taught to children across the country. We see a sort of message of, you know, that our country was born in the terrible sin of slavery.
And right.
We have seen no progress. We haven't seen any sort of optimistic hope for the future in terms of individual rights and freedoms. And that's actually, over time, something that encourages a sort of cynical attitude towards our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, the Supreme Court, Congress, the executive. So these are sort of long-term problems. But now that we know this is a problem, we can start thinking about, how do we teach our history? What do we teach our children about what our founding principles should be, for example?
This kind of critical theory indoctrination that we're seeing in public education at large in the nation right now, one would hope that at the lowest level, a cursory reading of actual historical fact should be able to combat the misinformation that's overtly anti-American. But instead, what we're seeing is an uncritical acceptance of these narratives. And unfortunately, that's raising whole generations that have anywhere from cynicism to sometimes even overt hatred for all that the United States is and stands for.
Yes, and it's especially discouraging to see that in the younger generation, because they face a number of challenges in terms of building trust as they grow older. You know, these kids these days, Gen Z as they're called, have been raised with technologies that actually make these problems worse, and that they feed them tiny tidbits of information that, you know, lack context. They spend a lot of time on platforms that reward hostility, anger, anxiety, fear. They don't reward the sorts of patience, compromise, the kinds of things that our founding fathers hoped as citizens and as Americans we would all find a way to get along, even when we disagree. And I think that their use of technology in particular rewards polarization, even on things that have nothing to do with politics. Mm-hmm. Not everything becomes an issue that you have to choose a team and stick to your team, and you're rewarded for that online. And what that means is that the quality and the quantity of their relationships offline start to suffer.
Right. So when you consider things like the 1619 Project that's attempting to rewrite the genesis of our nation, really what you're seeing is that Gen Z especially is espousing this antithetical narrative to the actual birth of the nation, right? They're choosing a camp, they're sticking with it, there's a conflict theory at play here, they're siding with the underdog, and so the nation, the government, the Constitution, all of these things are the problem that need to be attacked.
Yes, and it's the 1619 Project in particular is a good example of this, because it wasn't just a couple of ideologically motivated journalists at the New York Times who wanted to see this through.
Mm-hmm.
They very carefully and very effectively had this project turned into a curriculum that was then given out to public school students all across the nation and is being taught in many, many, many of our public schools.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to know this because my sons were handed one of these worksheets at one point when they were in high school. So I think one of the things that's discouraging about that is that then we lose this conversation about shared principles. What is it that we share as citizens, as a nation? So if you have children who are raised to think your country was born in moral sin, you know, everything is terrible, the future looks bleak, the planet is going to burn, these are the messages a lot of kids are being fed in the public education system. And it's very difficult even for well-intentioned families to combat that message if it's so consistently across the board negative for those kids in the school system.
So one core intellectual issue I have with that kind of a narrative, Christine, is that, okay, fine, if you want to claim that this is America's original sin, okay, then let's take a look at every other nation on the planet. Not a single one is devoid of their own original sins, slavery being for the vast majority of nations across the world. Some nations, a handful of them, especially in the Middle East, still continue to practice it. So it's really those founding ideals, those constitutional Judeo-Christian principles that make us a cut above the rest, and to detest that is to detest the very freedoms that have allowed for equal treatment of individuals, minority or otherwise.
Exactly. And I think there's certainly, you know, there's a way to teach history that teaches about all the conflict and the things we disagreed. I mean, look, we fought wars over the things that we disagreed about. And I think that the way of teaching that is to say there is something really special about the system that we have in this country and why 1776 is our founding. And it's because we had this small band of geniuses who'd been educated in a very ecumenical way at a very particular moment in our past where they could draw on so much information and knowledge and virtues of the past and then find an operable system of government that was like nothing else on earth. And it has continued to work. We are a constitutional republic, and that is, and we have survived. We're still quite young compared to many other countries, of course, but that's a story of optimism and hope. And I really think kids should be proud of what we've done as a country, even as we obviously know there are things that we shouldn't be proud of in terms of things that have happened in the past in this country.
Right, but we can acknowledge that mistakes as they were, we've learned tremendously from them, grown from them, and taught largely the rest of the world how to respond to those things.
Yes.
So we need to round off this segment. Christine, I'm greatly enjoying this conversation, and we will continue this conversation with Christine Rosen, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We are talking about Americans learning to trust again, and there are many underlying issues at play here. The core among these issues is the fact that there's a particular kind of pedagogical indoctrination at play that fosters distrust to the nation at large, let alone the judiciary, executive, and administrative branches of the nation. So stay tuned. We will continue this conversation. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Miss the beginning, can't catch the end, or you want to hear it again? All Ave Maria Radio programs can be heard at AveMariaRadio.net or on the Ave Maria Radio app. Then share it with your friends to help spread the Catholic faith. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is sponsored by Workforce Pay Hub, providing payroll, time tracking, HR management, and benefits administration, all with a dedicated customer-centric service team. More information can be found at workforcepayhub.com.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Hello, I'm Marian Kuharski, the director of Pro-Life Across America. We're non-political and totally educational. We don't scream or scold. Instead, we help people working through unplanned pregnancies know their options, and we rely on people like you to help with our mission. Check us out on Facebook, YouTube, or at prolifeacrossamerica.org.
What is catechesis and why do we care? The job of catechesis is to reveal all the joy as well as the demands of the way of Christ, says the Catholic Catechism. The way of Christ is summed up in the catechesis of the Beatitudes. Jesus gave us the 8 Beatitudes in his Sermon on the Mount. The Catholic Catechism tells us this teaching is the only path that leads to the eternal beatitude, happiness, for which the human heart longs. The catechesis of sin and forgiveness challenges us. Unless man acknowledges that he is a sinner, states the catechism, he cannot know the truth about himself, which is a condition for acting justly, and without the offer of forgiveness, man could not bear the truth. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
Some great people have shown respect for God. Can I read you a little quotation from Albert Einstein, who many times showed a great respect for religion and was one of the great admirers of Pope Pius XII for his stand against the Holocaust during the Second World War. Einstein wrote, "The fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious, is the fundamental emotion that stands at the cradle of all true art and science, a knowledge of the existence of something we can't penetrate, of the manifestations of the profoundest reason and the most radiant beauty, which are only accessible to our minds in the most elementary form. It is this knowledge and this emotion that constitute the truly religious attitude." Oh my, so beautifully said.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Christine Rosen, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We're talking about the general state of public distrust when it comes to the government and large institutions. So, Christine, we were talking earlier about indoctrination, the kind of pedagogy that takes place in the U.S. Some other societal factors also have exacerbated issues, COVID being one such issue. You highlight the fact that many people reported that after the events of COVID, they felt like the institutions they had put their faith in could no longer be trusted.
Yes, it was. I think this was an experience many Americans had. I mean, obviously, it was a very difficult time for the nation, for the world, and there were a lot of unknowns, which sparked a lot of fear and anxiety. All of these are understandable, but it's in those moments where we expect and hope our public institutions and our leaders will act in a way that is reassuring to the public, that is honest with the public, and that acknowledges what they do and don't know. Mm-hmm. And in all of those areas, our public institutions and many of our leaders failed us. So mm-hmm. I think people came out on the other side of that thinking basic things in life no longer work. We can't trust that if we go to the store, there'll be things on the shelves. We mm-hmm. can't trust that the person, if you lived in the state, in some states like Minnesota and elsewhere, you couldn't trust that your neighbor wouldn't call a hotline and tell on you to the government. I mean, these were not the kinds of experiences Americans were used to having, and it was very disorienting and very much contributed to an already declining sense of trust. So I think the other part of that, too, of course, is that it was a very isolating experience mm-hmm. for everyone. And one of the things we have also seen decline that I think we could be a little optimistic about turning around in the future are some of our local organizations, community-based organizations, voluntary organizations. These are the kind of civic institutions that are driven by people's understanding that we need to spend a lot of our time helping others, not for pay, not for resume building, but because we're all in this together mm-hmm. as human beings, and we need to be there for each other, particularly in our local communities. That was also something that really came to a halt during COVID. If you were a volunteer at a local nonprofit, for example, you couldn't go in and help the people you usually helped. And I think for children in particular, we're seeing each generation be less likely to want to volunteer for those sorts of opportunities. Those are trust-building institutions. They're civic institutions, and they're very important, as is, of course, obviously, our religious institutions, which also bring people together and do a great deal more for communities than merely serve as places where one can worship.
And so when you consider the fact that the average American dealing with COVID, understanding, we're acknowledging the fact that even our governments weren't quite sure how to deal with this as it was happening. The sentiment of the public, as you noted, is that there was a kind of sanctimonious condescension from the level of the governing elites and especially the medical sphere for those yes. who even deigned to ask questions about what was going on, when they could expect normalcy, and that has greatly impacted public trust.
Certainly, and I think everyone experienced it at one point or another during the pandemic, being told a noble lie, as they call it, where a public official said, "We're just going to tell you what we think you can handle," which isn't always, of course, the full truth of and the full extent of what's going on. Mm-hmm. We saw this over debates, in particular about social distancing, the closing of civic spaces and playgrounds being shut down, churches not allowed to have people even sit outside in congregations, come together even outside and with some social distancing, the masking of extremely young children, the closing of schools. My own kids were out of school for an entire year. There was no reason for that. We knew that it was safe for children to be in some of these spaces, and we knew how crucial and those were to their development, both educationally and emotionally. So mm-hmm. we were being told by the people who we placed in charge with our vote that they knew better. But what we've come to find out, even during the time, but certainly quite a bit afterwards, is that they didn't. And there hasn't really been a reckoning in the public sphere about that. So I think that also contributes to a continued sense of mistrust long after the pandemic has thankfully ended.
So let's talk about big picture then. As a result of those societal factors, but also the poor economy, every study I read, and I continue to read them, one of the strongest metrics of predictors of public trust for the government has been a poorly or strongly performing economy. And given the fact that the economy is where it is, public trust of the government is also waning, right? So you consider all of these factors. The distrust of quote-unquote big government and definitely big institutions, big corporations, it's created a kind of reverse effect, if you will, in that people are returning to subsidiary models of subsidiarity, small-scale mm-hmm. institutions, small-scale volunteer institutions. So tell us about that.
Yes, that's actually, it's a very hopeful sign, I think. I think we see this not just in the everyday business world, but in terms of media institutions. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people were correctly suspicious of what they were being told by the media throughout COVID. And also, you know, again, past COVID, when it came to things like the terrible spike in the cost of goods, inflation was real. And oftentimes people would turn on their televisions or open their computers and they were being told by mainstream media outlets that, oh, no, inflation's not a problem. You, this is just in your imagination. When they're looking at their grocery bill at their kitchen table, they know mm-hmm. it's not their imagination. So that drives them to seek alternative sources of information, alternative ways of doing things, because the old ways are broken. And so I think in some sense, you could see that in a fearful way, but I choose to see it as an opportunity. I think it's good if our public officials understand that they have to earn our trust. Trust is something you earn. Same with media institutions. There are alternatives now. You can go to Substack. You can go online. There are, mm-hmm. there are lots of alternatives where thoughtful journalists and thoughtful writers can reach an audience without having that gatekeeping effect of, you know, a corporate media empire, which has a particular ideological bent. So these are all good things if we take advantage of them and really use them to try to rebuild the principles we're talking about here, about right. trust, about community, about religious institutions. And I think that's really where, particularly for younger people, that's going to be the challenge of their generation.
Right. So let's talk about community a little more. With widespread trust distrust for larger institutions, including government and corporations, are we seeing a lot more development in terms of local communities and local efforts?
Not yet. No, I mean, not enough, I would say. Mm-hmm. Look, let's start with our neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, most people live in neighborhoods. Many, many Americans live in a neighborhood where they don't know their neighbors. And yep. they are more likely to know the name of an Instagram influencer than they are to know the person who lives a block away. And that's not good.
No, I think it's
that's
not.
Really not good. Because we need to be there for each other in person. We are embodied creatures, right?
Yeah.
We are human beings who can, there's a lot we can do online. There are a lot of opportunities to connect to people. You can look, I'm still in touch with friends from summer camp from when I was a kid. It's
wow.
great. However, when you're sick, who's going to come to your door with some soup and an offer of help? Who's going to actually, you know, when you have an elderly neighbor who needs their sidewalk, you know, shoveled out from the snow, who's going to do that? It's not going to be the person who's a million miles away on the screen. So we need to get back to those sorts of in-person, face-to-face relationships in our own communities. And everyone has an opportunity to do that. Wherever you live, should make an effort to meet your neighbors, get to know them, be available to them. And you can, it does take effort. It's kind of scary if you haven't met a lot of people to go and introduce yourself and get to know each other. But that's how it starts, communities at the yeah. local level.
A big component of community building is also religious community building. So would you comment on yeah. that?
Yes. I mean, one of the things we're seeing recently, and this is worrisome to me, is the rise of secular or what's called non-religiously affiliated Americans. That's mm-hmm. people who identify as atheist, agnostic, or religiously unaffiliated. That's more than 25% of this country now. And that is the highest number it has ever been since they started surveying religious affiliation many, many decades ago. So that strikes me as there's a chicken and egg problem here, right? Is that because of declining trust in institutions, and that includes religious institutions, or is our lack of trust in each other a sign of our lack of faith? And I think it's unfortunately probably the latter. So mm-hmm. that's a real challenge if you're the leader of a religious institution. How do you get people back into the pews, back into the institution, and also create opportunities in the future for the next generation?
Well, thank you so much, Christine. You've definitely given us a lot to ponder. My guest has been Christine Rosen, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and we've been talking about the general state of public distrust of large corporations and government here in the United States of America. Faith and community are the ways forward. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Did you know my mom's gonna have a baby? We heard the heartbeat and my dad said this is gonna be someone very special.
Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. We hope you'll consider supporting the work of Pro-Life Across America. Your gift will help offer life-saving alternatives to those in need. Visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org or like us on Facebook.
Pro-Life Across America.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John chapter 11, verses 21 to 26. This is the story of Lazarus. Lazarus has died. Lazarus is one of his best friends. Just before this passage, we hear the news that Martha and Mary send word to Jesus that the one you love is sick. And the next line in the scripture is, now because Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus, he stayed where he was. His friend's in need, he can heal, they've seen him heal before, and yet somehow because he loves him, he stays, and Lazarus dies. And then Jesus shows up 3 days later and is greeted by Martha and Mary, who confront him with the words, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would never have died. Rather applicable for many of us in our lives. We ask the Lord to do one thing because we're certain it is what we think is best, when in fact he has something which far surpasses what we asked for. The challenge is, in waiting for that to happen, we go through very trying times, which oftentimes makes us wonder, does he really care?
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I said to the sisters one day, what do you think you're going to look like in heaven?
Oh, some of them had absolutely magnificent ideas. I didn't think of one of them. So I got desperate because then my turn came. I didn't know what to say. And so in desperation, I said, what do you think I'll wear in heaven? And they all said with one voice, armor!
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review. Welcome back to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, and as I mentioned at the open to this hour, in this segment we are going to hear the last interview Al Cresta ever recorded. Question is, what changed after the fall? What changed in nature with the fall of Adam's sin? Al Cresta speaks with Matthew Ramage, professor of theology at Benedictine College and adjunct professor of sacred scripture at Holy Apostles College and Seminary. Take it away, Al.
Most of us assume that the fall introduced suffering, death, decay into the cosmos, but we don't know the extent of it. We think that it's clear from passages of scripture. But then when pushed, we ask ourselves, wait a minute, what was the world of entomology like before the fall? And did that change after the fall? Were bugs different? Yeah. So, and we realize we haven't really thought this through at all. So go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. It's really a joy to be able to think it through, to really do theology, right? So we have catechesis is teaching the faithful what we already know definitively.
Right.
But theology really does have room to explore here. I'm reminded of a line from your show. I'm sure you've said it many times, but when we're talking about dicey or hot button or even fascinating theological topics like this, there is room for legitimate diversity of opinion. I love the quote from Augustine that we should have unity in the essentials, liberty in doubtful manners, and all things charity. So
right.
When I teach this with my students, that's what I lead with, that you could have multiple opinions on this. I was interested. I've been researching faith and science basically as an area of writing and expertise the last 15 years. I'm a Thomist by training and love the Fathers and Ratzinger. But this area is so important. I always get so many questions. Well, default assumption would be all death came through sin. That's the easiest, simplest read of Paul. But then you realize the Fathers aren't all agreed on that. And then you realize actually the common doctor, Thomas Aquinas, didn't think that. So It's really interesting that Thomas thinks that humans were originally exempt, but fundamentally nature wasn't altered because of the fall, so that he mentions falcons, lions were never herbivores.
Yeah,
I was so consoled when I read Thomas say that, because all of the scientific evidence we have tells us that these creatures were carnivores for millions of years before humans existed. So it's really consoling when you really research these topics to say, wow, the church is pretty smart.
we were thinking this right beforehand. Yes, very good. So
the question that I was taking up is, well, what actually happened, you know? And so there's multiple things that you can say about that. But I love going to Ratzinger. It's fascinating to me that when he became pope, he really made ecology a focus.
Yeah.
You probably remember he got the moniker the Green Pope.
Yeah, no, I remember well. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, Francis is so known for this. Actually, I'm working on a book right now, and this Catholic World Report column, Benedict has every bit as much on the environment and his classically, you know, sane, balanced, readable prose, he explains quite a bit. So teasing that out is super important. And one of the things he talks about on this concept is that, no, Adam's sin probably did not affect the existence of termites or cause bats to start flying and mosquitoes to start biting and things like this. However, our relationship with things changes because of the fall. And that's where he looks to the key. There's so many examples, but I'm thinking of from a human point of view.
Sure.
What would it look like if I stick my finger on a thorn, or like I did, I gashed my leg and I'm on blood thinners and I let out a four-letter word, I'm pretty sure. If I was unfallen versus fallen, it's the relationship with that pain. Pain itself has been in the animal kingdom from time immemorial. So that's part of the approach that he takes.
Yeah. So we don't have to believe that the second law of thermodynamics begins after the fall.
Exactly.
Right.
So, yeah, and you'll talk to young Earth creationists, mainly among our separated brethren,
right,
who think that the laws of nature completely changed, which they're throwing out there to try to reconcile a very literalist 6,000-year-old world. But thankfully, I'm going to a conference right now on faith and science and the reconciliation, and that's just not necessarily the Catholic view, which is great because we have so many popes and doctors that show us that the fullness of faith involves the both and of faith and science.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is, well, while we have young earth creationists among some evangelicals and Protestant fundamentalists, we, those of us who accept evolution in its general picture, I have to deal with life before the emergence of Homo sapiens. And it's clear that that life included death and decay. How have Catholics dealt with that? Has it ever been a problem for them? Or have they always been able to accept that fact as we look backwards and the dates stretch, you know, backwards more and more?
Yeah, looking back, I actually see a plurality of views within the one orthodoxy.
Okay.
Kind of interesting that Augustine already in the 4th century talked about how it's the very law of natural transitory things that they pass, that so we may be repelled by mortality.
Yeah.
In this particular corner of the cosmos, but it's because we fail to perceive the beauty of the larger pattern of the universe. And so Augustine comes up with the example of when we fail to appreciate the way that God has built the Paschal mystery, if you will, into creation, it's like the sick man is disgusted by healthy bread, he says. It's not the bread's fault. However, yeah, when you're sick, food doesn't taste good.
Yeah.
So he compares that to how we need to have this interior renewal, both spiritually and intellectually, to really appreciate what God has done in both of his books, the book of Scripture, and his first book, the book of the created order. But yeah, I'm sure that you can find many people who also say among the fathers that Adam's sin caused everything.
Yeah.
If I may, one interesting view is St. Maximus the Confessor, who's sort of an Eastern-Western bridge, late church father.
Right.
Talks about how Adam's sin caused all death. However, God, being outside of time, created the earth with the consequences of Adam's later fall already in view. That's
really
not necessarily the approach I take, but I like to offer that to people. It makes sense both of a very straightforward reading of Paul as well as the scientific data.
Yeah.
So there are various options out there that are within orthodoxy.
So when God looked upon the pre-fallen world and said, it is good, he was able to say that of a world that already had within it death for at least non-human creatures.
Right. And fascinatingly, on the creation account, if you read that very literally, it actually arguably endorses not only vegetarianism, but as Leon Cass says, a hyper-vegetarianism where you don't kill anything whatsoever. And most biblical scholars, when we look at that, we realize it's not doing science in that regard any more than it's doing science of creation over six 24-hour days.
Right.
But it's using through the figurative language, as the Catechism says, it's making a picture of how idyllic the original state of mankind was, that truly whatever went on empirically, whether we stubbed our toes, tripped on our kids' prehistoric Legos or not, whether creatures were killing each other, which is pretty certain, that nevertheless, this is the idyllic Edenic scenario.
Yeah.
So we have to have the conversion then to see that and live that as such.
Yeah. To be able to see God's hand in that. How all of these things come together in a wonderful complexity that ultimately gives glory to God's majesty. So that's going to require some thinking, I think, rethinking for a lot of us who have kind of accepted the more traditional understanding of nothing died before the fall. But again, if you take the scientific evidence seriously, you've got to come to grips with the presence of death before Homo sapiens. And so what does this say to the way we approach the world of ecology these days and the concerns that we have in helping to steward our creation?
I do think it has a lot of consequences. While I admire vegetarians, first of all, I don't have the spiritual power to not eat meat. So I'm not objective in this matter, but really it means we are authorized, even commanded by Christ to eat his flesh and to drink his blood. Well, Christians have always been able to consume meat. So while we might admire vegetarians not having meat, actually, we realize that to live, you have to kill.
Yeah.
It is our creaturely state. It's weird. It requires conversion to understand it. But we live by taking the lives of others. The key then for me becomes we have to learn to give our lives in reciprocity as well. And so, you know, you're constantly killing bacteria, viruses from your immune system. You're constantly accidentally eating bugs, probably. You know, if you're eating a carrot, you're killing the whole plant. If you pick off lettuce, you're not necessarily killing the whole plant. And so it's interesting that though they are so far removed from us, as far as the kinship of life goes, yeah, to pick up that beet is to take a life.
Yeah.
And the way that Pope Benedict looked at it was that the entire cosmos has this paschal structure that all creation is in Christ.
Yes.
And that's why we see this.
And that's critical, I think, in what you're writing here, to understand the paschal structure that is built into creation. And so, again, that giving in death is part of the creation. Matthew, let's talk again sometime. Thank you.
Great. Nice talking, Al.
That was the last interview Al Cresta ever recorded with Matthew Ramage on April 4th, 2024.